long line of times when people close to me would try to put me down, put me in my place, underestimate me, or take advantage of me. But she, above all, was the most devastating because she was the most essential. She was my mother. Dandelion tea.
A flower taught me how to pray, but as I grew, that flower changed. She started flailing in the wind like golden petals scattering.
Petals. She called herself Dandelion, the hardy, bright yellow wildflower with small, tooth-shaped petals that gives the early signal that spring is near. After its flowering is finished, the petals dry and the head becomes a ball of lacy dust feathers carrying seeds. The legend goes that if you close your eyes, make a wish, and blow the feathery pieces into the air, your wish will scatter into the world and come true. The English sometimes call them Irish daisies, and the tea made from the root and leaves is widely believed to have healing benefits. But these wildflowers can also be a menace, poisoning precious flowers and growing grass, weeds to be uprooted and discarded. When I was a little girl, my older sister seemed to live on the wind. She was always somewhere far away. Childhood memories of her exist in my mind as flashes of lightning and thunder. She was exciting but unpredictable. Her torrential gusts always carried inevitable destruction with them. The distances between my mother, my father, their first daughter, and myself are far-reaching. Unlike her, growing up, I never spent any significant time as part of a whole interracial family. Most of my experiences were with one parent at a time, me with my mother or me with my father. I have no recollection of them as a happily married couple. It is bizarre to me that they were even married, not just because of race, but how different they were as people. But before I was born, the Carey family consisted of a black father, a white mother, and a mixed boy and girl. The four of them would walk down the street and people would know. This rebel Carey quartet experienced the spectacular ignorance and wrath of a society woefully unprepared to receive or accept them. Loving v. Virginia, the Supreme Court decision that struck down the law banning interracial marriage in the United States, wouldn't happen until 3 years after my mother and father's marriage. As a result of the hostility from their community and country, Morgan and Allison were instructed by our parents to refer to them as mother and father, in the hope, I imagine, that the formality might elevate their status to respectable. My parents seemed to think that if neighbors or other onlookers heard their girl and boy say, "Good morning, mother," or "Hello, father," they wouldn't perceive them as disgusting. Morgan and Allison were beautiful children and were very close when they were young. Allison had skin like creamy butterscotch pudding with a head of thick, deep, dark curls and eyes to match. She was extremely intelligent and curious, and she loved to learn. I was told she brought home good grades, got into good schools, and loved music, too. But she lived firsthand the discomfort and animosity directed at her and her offbeat black and white family. She saw their neighbors throw raw meat studded with broken glass to their dogs and their family car blown up. She saw things inside the family, too. Things a child should never see, and I will never know. I do know that what she experienced damaged and derailed her girlhood. She was fully aware when the family unit unraveled and our parents turned on each other. She absorbed the full pain of a family coming undone. She also saw another daughter come into the clan, breaking the symmetry and changing her status as the only girl and youngest. I was the new little one. When my mother and father could no longer live together without emotionally torturing each other, they tore themselves apart to survive separately. The three of us children would be plagued by pain, resentment, and jealousy for a lifetime. Allison and Morgan both believed I had it easier than they did. Our father was very strict with them. He was not harsh with me because 3 or 4 years old was the oldest I had been when we were all together. During one of their countless fights, I vaguely remember my mother yelling at him something like, "This one is mine. You will not beat this one." I was her little one. She often said she didn't have the strength to challenge my father's aggression when my siblings were growing up. I only have one memory of all of us having dinner together. It was a sort of restorative dinner, my parents trying one more time to see if we could pull it together and be a family. We were all sitting around the table, and I started singing. My father said, "Children should be seen and not heard." The entertainer in me took that as a cue, so I got up from the dining table, walked a few feet to the living room area, which was in plain view and well within earshot, stood on top of the coffee table, and continued to sing at the top of my lungs. Allison and Morgan dropped their heads, ducking before the wrath of our father that they were certain would inevitably ricochet around the room. But my mother gave him a look, and he didn't say anything. My sister and brother were flabbergasted. I was not hit, yelled at, punished, or even stopped. They would have never, ever dared defy our father. No wonder they hated me. Needless to say, the dinner didn't save us. Divorce was inevitable. My mother and father made the final decision to break up before all was broken. I remember I was taken to our neighbor's house and they gave me popcorn while my family was next door discussing the dismantling of the Careys. After several violent encounters involving the police, by court order, my father and brother could not live together. At one point, Morgan had been taken to Sagamore Children's Psychiatric Center, a care facility for seriously emotionally troubled children and families in crisis. Morgan was a crisis. I also heard a psychiatrist had concluded that a significant contributing factor in Morgan's behavioral problems was Allison, who had a talent for instigating and manipulating Morgan to his breaking points. Allison is very clever. So Morgan had to live with my mother, and she had made it clear to my father that he would not have me. That left Allison scattered. I've heard Allison express that she felt like my mother tossed her away, that she clearly loved Morgan and me more than her. I've also heard my mother say Allison chose to live with our father because she felt bad and didn't want him to be alone. There is likely some truth in both of their perspectives. I was too young to really understand. I don't really know what life was like for my sister living with our father, just the two of them, broken and angry. It must have been dangerously claustrophobic, a constant clashing of feelings of abandonment and resentment toward my mother under their roof. They had no real space to resolve, no chance to heal. Order and obedience was how my father tried to make sense out of the chaos of society and the rubble his family structure had become. The child now in his sole care was a bitter, broken teenage girl, and he had no tools to deal with her dysfunction and hurt. Eventually, my father and Allison did form a bond, united in their disdain for my mother. I believe they also bonded over the inevitable visibility of their blackness. Predictably, Allison turned to boys and sex in an attempt to fill the family-sized hole of rejection in her heart. At 15, she met a handsome black 19-year-old military man, and Allison got pregnant. Our mother wanted her to have an abortion. Our father told her she could have the baby if she got married. The young man was stationed in the Philippines, and with our father's permission, Allison followed him, and they got married there. Before she left, I recall sitting on the bed with her in her room in our father's house. What I remember of her room was that on her wall was a shelf of books and a shelf of fancy dolls. The ones with big, poofy lace, quinceañera-type dresses. I would look up at those dolls far out of my reach, there for show, not for playing. I was staring at them when she pointed to her belly and said, "There's a baby in there." A baby where? In her stomach? I was too young and didn't understand at all what she meant. I didn't understand much about Allison then. I'll never forget her bizarre combined baby and bridal shower at my mother's house. They put a little girl on the cake, a doll. Not one that looked like a grown woman, but a little baby doll with dark brown hair like my sister's. The whole thing was so confusing to me. I was a little girl wondering, is this a baby is coming party or a girl is going party? I couldn't tell if it was a festive or tragic occasion. My mother was pacing and pissed off. My teenage sister had a swollen belly, and she kept pointing at it and saying to me, "There's a baby in here. Look, there's a baby in here." And there was this weird cake with a little doll on it. How was a little girl supposed to understand all of this? And so, for a long time afterward, I always thought, Okay, so I guess at 15 is when people have kids and get married. It twisted my reality, but it also focused me. I made the promise to myself that was not going to be me. My sense of self-worth, or rather, my sense of self-preservation, was born at that bon voyage slash bridal slash baby shower. I vowed I was not going to be promiscuous, ever. This promise to live a different life led me to become a very prudish person. I knew then, suddenly finding myself an auntie before I was 8 years old, that Allison's path was not going to be my life. Once the last slice of baby bridal cake was gone, my sister was gone too, for several years. I will never understand what happened to her in the Philippines, but I do know when she left my father's house, the remainder of her fragile childhood was left behind. After a few years in the Philippines, Allison returned to Long Island. I was about 12 years old and she was 20. Whatever happened to her over there, or on Long Island, or in a back room somewhere, had taken its toll on her. That super smart, beautiful girl with the dark curls, who was my big sister, had hardened into a strange kind of absence. Something, or many things, must have happened to her to lead her to barter her body for money and drugs, as she went on to do for years. Back then, there was so much I didn't know. But there was also so much I should have never found out, certainly not so young. The years between us might as well have been centuries. When Allison came back, she would drift from place to place and man to man, occasionally crashing with us at my mother's house between the many random relationships with men she collected and discarded. There was one older man, I guessed he was about 60. He had half a head of hair, all of which was gray. He was polite to my mother and would sometimes fill our refrigerator with food, so I guess she trusted him. One evening at the shack, Allison and my mother got into one of their innumerable epic arguments, and for some unknown reason, Allison took me with her to this older gentleman's house. There's little of his house or that night that I remember because when we arrived, Allison sat me down on a light brown couch and handed me a little chalky ice blue pill with a crease carved down the middle and a glass of water. "Here, take this," she said. I took it. Within minutes, I think, I was in a heavy, scary darkness, pushed down into a place beneath sleep, and I couldn't pull myself out. I don't know how long I was knocked out. I felt like I'd been absorbed into the couch. The only reason I remember the color. It was harrowing. At 12, I probably weighed 80 pounds soaking wet, and Allison gave me a whole Valium. I don't know why my sister drugged me. I don't know why my mother let me go with her and this man. Perhaps they both wanted me out of their hair for the evening, but my life was in jeopardy in her hands. This may have been the first time that year she could have seriously hurt me, but it certainly wasn't the last. Even though by her 20s, Allison had already gotten married, given birth, gotten divorced, traveled thousands of miles away, and done dreadful things, she could still be zany and spontaneous. The worst had not yet happened between us, so I was genuinely happy for the wild stray visits she made to my mother's house. On her good days, she was a bright burst of energy in our often bleak little dwelling. She seemed mature and had a hollow kind of glamour. She took a new interest in me as a preteen now rather than a little girl. She paid attention to the obviously neglected outside of me, swooping in and correcting my disastrous attempts to make myself pretty, which to a 12-year-old means everything. After I accidentally made my hair all kinds of shades of ugly orange, she took me to get a toner from my hair and made it one color. She took me to a place that made my eyebrows beautiful. She took me shopping for my first bra. She and I would make earnest attempts at being normal. We were trying to be sisters, or so I thought. Even though I was young, I knew my sister was doing things that were not good. I mean, she had a beeper, and only drug dealers, rappers, and doctors had beepers back then. She wore a nice manicure, bright pink nail polish, sometimes decorated with rhinestones. Once, as she was dropping me off in front of my mother's house, she dipped a sharp, pink nail tip into some white crystal powder and held it up to my face, saying, "Just try it. Just try a little bit. Who cares?" I knew it was cocaine and it scared me to death. Thank God I didn't take the sniff. I played it off and calmly replied, "No thanks. Bye. See you later." I shudder to think what could have happened if I'd walked into her trap and then that house. I don't know what would have happened if I'd snorted cocaine right before seeing my mother or ever in my life. It was all such a setup. Allison began bringing me around her friends, and I started looking forward to our secret outings, though for all the initial glamour and excitement, it was a very scary time in my life. Even though it was a long time ago, I still have nightmares about it. Allison did not choose how her life began, and I know she went through trauma, too. It seemed as though she turned completely away from the light. One day, she explained that it was time for me to meet her fabulous boyfriend, John, and the other girl she hung around, who she'd been telling stories to me about. John was tall, with green eyes, a large, fluffy afro, and a strong charisma. Christine, a 17-year-old runaway white girl, an older woman named Denise, older, meaning she was maybe 28, and my sister, then in her early 20s, all lived in a house together with John. I looked up to Christine. She had a worldly air about her, yet she also seemed like a little girl. Her pale skin was sprinkled with tan freckles, and she had medium blonde hair that fell softly to her shoulders, which were long and thin like the rest of her body. She could have been in a teen movie, but instead, she was there, in that house. She was damaged. John's house was nicer, brighter, and cleaner than where I lived. They had a brand new couch. There was a television, and I could watch whatever shows I wanted. They had all the snacks I could want. They had juicy juice. We couldn't afford any of that at home. A couple of times, my sister came to where I lived and filled the refrigerator with the stuff I liked. This was part of the confusion I felt about our relationship. It sometimes felt and looked like she cared, but her motives were always unclear. Was she being a nice big sister, or was she creating an appetite in me for what I knew I could have all the time at John's house? It was manipulation masquerading as love. My sister told me not to tell anyone I was going to the house where she lived with John, especially not my brother. She told me that my brother didn't like him because John had beat him at backgammon. Being so young and naive at the time, I believed their animosity was about a board game, not a prostitution and drug operation. So there was no one who knew, no one to protect me. Dysfunctional families are ideal prey for abusers, the exposed little ones vulnerable to being picked off. Now, of course, it's clear to me that the fun house was a whorehouse. I think my sister was kind of like the hustler, the talent scout, but at the time, I had no idea. After all, I was only a 12-year-old girl. Winning me over was so easy, literally like giving a kid candy, but instead of candy, it was a hair rinse, a bra, and a juicy juice box. John, my sister, and I would drive to the city together. I remember one time we were going somewhere and the radio was playing a song he loved. He loudly screamed out the lyrics while my sister and I giggled at his strangled singing. They let me smoke cigarettes in the backseat of the car. I felt cool and free. We would go to IHOP to get pancakes. They took me to Adventureland, and I played Pac-Man. In those moments, I almost felt like someone's precious little sister. I was having all these fun adventures and thinking to myself, I finally know what it feels like to have a big sister who's in my life for good. And I like this easy breezy guy, John. This was what I'd been missing. I was starting to feel something resembling stability, a sense that I had something that looked like a normal family and was moving towards somewhere I belonged. But confusing and curious things quickly started happening. The closer I got to my sister, the more clearly I could see her broken parts. She had secretly gotten me my own phone line, which only she called me on. She would have these desperate bouts of drug-induced hysteria and call me late at night in the middle of an episode. I'd talk her down off the ledge, then try to go back to sleep, get up early in the morning, and complete the seventh grade. No one at school knew that frequently, just a few hours earlier, I had subdued my suicidal big sister. Killing herself became a common threat that she shared with me in the wee hours before I went to the school bus stop. Then the call stopped for a while. Finally, one day, Allison phoned and said she and John were coming to pick me up. I was excited to think of the three of us together again, riding, laughing, smoking, singing, and playing. But John showed up alone. We began driving, but there was no radio blasting, no talking. It wasn't fun at all, and I felt that something wasn't right. Finally, I asked, "Where's my sister? When are we going to pick her up?" John kept his eyes forward and assured me, "Oh, she'll be here later." I was sitting in the front seat, and I could clearly see the handgun resting against his thigh. John, his gun, and I made two stops, a card game and a drive-in movie. There's a look, a feel, and a smell to rooms where grown men play in the dark. It was dank and cluttered. The air was dense with cheap booze, stale menthol cigarette smoke, and unspoken perversions. There were no pretty things. It was hard for me to see and hard to breathe. I don't know exactly how many men were there. I don't know how many guns, how much money, or how many vile thoughts were at the table, but I do know it was all men and me. I sat in a corner on the sticky floor where I could see the door and held on to myself. I stayed still and kept my eyes down as the grown man jokes, grown man cussing, grown man hungers, grown man fears, and grown man fantasies flew above my head. Every now and then, I'd catch a glimpse of one of them leering at me or hear a few lewd references to me in their conversation. I don't remember how I got from the card room floor back into the front seat of his car. What I do remember is feeling dirty from the sticky floor and the men's filthy words. I knew my sister was not coming to clean me up this time. A panic bubbled up in my throat. Where am I going? Why am I alone with my sister's boyfriend? Why did he take me around those disgusting men? Why can't we just go to IHOP? Where is my sister? Where is she? I began to pray. Our next stop was the drive-in, where almost immediately John put his arm around me. My body went stiff. My eyes were fixed on his gun. John pushed in closer and forced a hard kiss on me. I was nauseous and scared. I felt immobilized. From the corner of my eye, I noticed an elderly white man pull up and park next to us, peering directly into John's car. The look on the man's face was a mix of revulsion and recognition. He clearly saw an adult man, John, with his round afro, and a little girl, small, with blonde coils of hair. He saw the powder blue car and John's light brown skin. He saw the details, and even if he didn't detect my distress, he could see this was no place a little girl would ever want to be. John pulled out of the drive-in slowly and drove me home in silence. I committed that man's face to memory. He is still there, fresh and frozen in that terrible time. I believe he was a prayer in person. After a couple of days back in my room, the phone began ringing again, but this time I wouldn't pick it up. I resumed pretending I had a regular seventh grade life. I wanted to be a child again. Sometimes all the kids in my neighborhood would play chase, tag, at night. Most of them lived in nice houses with two parents and sisters who didn't burden them with thoughts of suicide and set them up with pimps. I longed to blend in to a typical summer night in an everyday Long Island neighborhood, to play and clown around with other regular kids. I just wanted to outrun my drama through a game of chase. We often played in an area not far from the beach that had a kind of roundabout. We would hang out at that spot and sometimes build a fire, make funny voices, and sing. One night, we were deep in a group game of chase, kids scattered about, running and weaving, when I saw a car coming down the road. I immediately recognized it as John's car. It was creeping along, ever so slowly, as if the driver was looking for something or someone. Panicking, I instinctively ducked behind a house, pretending to hide from whoever was it. There was no way I could tell my friends that I was it to a pimp with a gun. John eventually drove away. Though I had narrowly escaped him again, the fear of men followed me for a very long time. When I got home, I unplugged the phone from the wall and disconnected from trusting my big sister forever. I had nobody to tell what happened. I couldn't tell my mother. I didn't have any real close friends. I had never really fit in. Even if I did, how could I have explained it to a kid from a regular household who ate dinner at 6 o'clock, went to bed at 9:30, and got in trouble when they didn't brush their teeth? They'd never be able to understand. Big sisters are supposed to protect you, not pimp you out. So I didn't tell or trust anybody. But as a girl, you still want your big sister, and dandelions are still flowers when they first bloom. One visit from my sister, among all the visits and memories, marked me the deepest. We tried to have tea. Tea was a thing in my mother's house, but it was anything but proper. There was no cheery, whistling kettle. We boiled the water in a small, beat-up saucepan on an old stove in the tiny, flavorless, dingy, grime-colored kitchen. Matching cups and saucers were certainly nowhere to be found. We had mismatched cups and mugs, the kind found in the box marked free at yard sales on Long Island. English breakfast was the staple tea flavor. We each had a cup with a steeping tea bag. I had a thick ceramic brown dip glazed mug that was chipped at the lip. I was holding the steaming, fragrant black tea with both hands when the phone rang. "Oh, hello, Al," we heard our mother answer. It was our father. We were both a little shocked. My father rarely called my mother's house, and if he did, it was almost always to scold us about something. Allison and I exchanged a quick glance. Who had done what now? Suddenly, my mother looked in my direction, and I could tell they were discussing me. I vigorously shook my head no and mimed refusal. Allison and I were just about to have tea, maybe even a rare light moment, and I knew I'd have to get serious when it came to talking with our father. And who knew what Allison might have done that I'd have to hear about? But Mother didn't cover for us. "Yes, she's here. Hold on," she said, holding the phone out and shaking it at me. Whatever normal sister moment Allison and I were trying to create was totally blown. I straightened my face, got up begrudgingly, and took the phone. Then I shook it and stretched the cord over to Allison, gesturing for her to take it. "No, you take it," she said back. A silly back and forth commenced between us for a few moments, a game of who would take the burden of talking to Father. It was almost fun. Finally, I put the receiver to my ear. "Hi, Father." "I'm fine," I said, repressing the urge to let out a little giggle. As I went through the mechanical niceties of the conversation, my sister began gesturing wildly, shaking her head and slicing her hand across her throat, signaling for me not to let on that she was there. As I tried my best to carry on the conversation with our father, I made silly faces back at her, doing all I could not to break into laughter. My sister could be pretty theatrical, and in that moment, I found her extra hilarious. I thought we were playing a game. Eventually, I figured it was her turn to try and talk seriously to our father while I tried to make her laugh, so I said, "Guess what? Allison is here. Want to talk to her?" Laughingly, I motioned to her to take the phone. But she wasn't looking at me. She was looking down at her mug of still steaming tea in her hand, and when she lifted her face, her eyes were rabid, without a trace of their former playfulness. Before I realized what was happening, she yelled, "No!" and, in a flash, threw the boiling hot tea on me. The next thing I remember, I was stripped down to my waist, and a doctor was removing the remaining bits of my white and turquoise diagonal striped top, which was embedded into the flesh of my shoulder with large tweezers. The doctor had had to slice off my shirt with an instrument, as some of the fibers had begun to fuse with my skin. I fucking loved that top, one of the very few cute pieces I had, and now it was out of rotation, stuck to my back. My back was splattered with third-degree burns. I couldn't recognize it as mine, as it turned different shades of maroon from the violent scalding I received at the hands of my sister. The horrific physical sensation had been so intense that I blacked out. Afterward, my back was numb and couldn't be touched without causing me excruciating pain. It took years before I could accept a simple pat on the back, as most of my skin had to completely renew and repair itself. The deepest injury, though, was from the emotional trauma. Feelings are not like skin. There are no fresh new cells coming to replace ruined ones. Those scars go unseen, unacknowledged, and unhealed. The truly irreversible damage to me came from the burn of my big sister, not the tea. Her arson was deliberate. She burned my back and my trust. Any faint hope I'd held up to that point of having a big sister became scorched earth. I know my sister was deeply wounded. She is the most brilliant and broken person I have ever known. I may never understand what hurt her so badly it made her hurt so many others in return, but to me, she was her own most permanently damaged victim. From my perspective, she chose to take up permanent residence in victim land. The promise of her life was squandered in a tragic series of cheap bargains rather than being redeemed through the difficult, lifelong work of recovery and rebuilding oneself. Allison has burned me in many ways, and more times than I can count. Over and over, I have tried to be her fire department, financing treatments and paying for stays and premium rehabs. But even with substantial resources, there is no way to rescue someone who doesn't realize they're burning. The scars I carry from my sister are not just a reminder, they are lessons. They have taught me that perhaps our worlds are far too different to ever overlap. Hers made of fire and mine of the light. I always hoped and wished Allison would get better so we could get better. I understand she was severely emotionally injured and had to take her enduring pain out on someone. She chose me. Through the years, both my sister and brother have put me on the chopping block, sold lies to any gossip rag or trashy website that would buy or listen. They have attacked me for decades, but when I was 12 years old, my sister drugged me with Valium, offered me a pinky nail full of cocaine, inflicted me with third-degree burns, and tried to sell me out to a pimp. Something in me was arrested by all that trauma. That is why I often say, I'm eternally 12. I am still struggling through that time.
And I miss you, Dandelion, and even love you. And I wish there was a way for me to trust you. But it hurts me every time I try to touch you.
Petals. Detangled and swept away. In the photograph, bright rays of sun shine down on me like a spotlight, and the hot dog I'm holding has a big, happy bite taken out of it. My hair is a range of gold highlights, raw sienna, wheat blonde, and sweet lemon, lit by the sun. Soft, thick waves of it are blowing in layers away from my face as a few ringlets sweep up off my shoulders. There is a tenderness in my gaze, cut slightly with seriousness at the edges of my eyes. This photo is one of my favorite from my childhood. In it, I look like a typical first grader on a summer break. I look like I belong to somebody who knows how to look after me. I appear well cared for, but I wasn't. My childhood was rife with neglect. There were many things about me that my mother didn't understand how to nurture or maintain, but the most obvious, most symbolic, and most visible was my hair. My hair was rooted to no one. No one did my hair. No one knew how. We didn't have conditioner or cream rinse, as it was called back in the day, at my mother's house. There were no pomades, wide tooth combs, or hard bristle brushes. There was no Sunday ritual of getting my hair washed and braided. Certainly, there was no greasing of the scalp. There was no order made in my hair. I never felt the tidiness or security of having my hair done. As a result, my hair was often a matted, tangled mesh, and no one around me could fully understand the particular humiliation of being a non-white little girl with unkempt hair. I didn't have the language for it, but I carried the burden of how it felt. My neglected hair was a siren signaling that I was different from all the little white girls, and from little black girls, too. My wild, mixed, and mangled curls made me feel inferior, unworthy of receiving proper attention. There was no going to the salon, darling. I don't recall my mother ever going to a salon. She fully subscribed to that bohemian, no-fuss beauty philosophy of the 1950s and 60s. For her, a full-beat face was eyeliner, a little cat wing if she was being extra fancy, a swish of mascara, a touch of blush, a lip, and voila, flawless face. Her hair was fabulous, either up or down. Even if she believed in seeking professional grooming services for her or me, we could never afford it. And besides, there were no salons in that part of Long Island that could comprehend the contradictions of my tendrils, the sheer complexities of the needs of my hair. At that time, there weren't mixed texture professionals anywhere, really, nor were there any specialized products. I was living tangled in between an Afro sheen and a Brett girl world. The two constant representations of female beauty I saw on a daily basis were my mother and TV commercials. I admired and deeply desired the dark, smooth perfection of my mother's long, luxurious hair. The contrast between how my mother's hair looked when she woke up in the morning and how mine did was profound. She would shake her head, and thick, straight hair would tumble down like a yard of heavy silk crepe, draping into an elegant pool across her shoulders. I, on the other hand, had smashed down fuzzy, sweaty clumps, exploding in a cacophony of knot waves and curls all over my head. And then there was the hair I saw on TV, the magnificent, sunshine-filled, slow motion blowing in the wind while running barefoot through fields of flowers hair. I was enchanted by those commercials, especially the ones for Clairol Herbal Essence Shampoo. It was as if Eve herself was in the Garden of Eden, bottling the thick emerald green nectar made of earthly delights of herbs and wildflowers. I was convinced this shampoo would give me the heavenly hair blown by gusts of angels' wings that I saw in the commercial. I wanted that shampoo so bad. I wanted that angelic blowing hair so bad. Because of those commercials, Olivia Newton-John and the boss, Diana Ross, I am still obsessed with blowing hair, as evidenced by the wind machines employed in almost every photo shoot of me ever. Young and culturally isolated, I had no idea how to manage my hair, nor the shame it brought me. I often wonder if my mother ever saw the carelessness that my hair made visible. Was she too preoccupied with her own burdens to notice? Could she not feel the dryness and the lumps and bumps of the gnarly tangles in my head? Why couldn't she just sit me down and brush my hair for 2 hours, the way Marcia Brady did on the Brady Bunch? Maybe in her bohemian, 60s-loving ideology, she thought I looked free, like an adorable flower child. Maybe she didn't know I felt dirty. Having one black and one white parent is complicated, but when you're a little girl with a white mother, largely cut off from other black women and girls, it can be excruciatingly lonely. And, of course, I had no biracial role models or references. I understand why my mother didn't understand how to manage my hair. When I was a baby, it was, well, baby hair, mostly uniform, soft curls. As I got older, it got more complex, with diverse textures arising out of seemingly nowhere. She didn't know what was happening. She was confused and randomly started cutting tragic bangs in my hair, believing bangs would behave and biracial hair is brave. It was a disaster, and I felt powerless. At 7 years old, I really thought maybe if she would just wash my hair with herbal essence, a hair fairy would come at night, and I would wake up and poof, I would have perfect hair like my mom or the girls in the commercials. It took me 500 hours of beauty school training to know even Marcia Brady's hair wouldn't blow with abandon with just shampoo. It takes professionals, products, and production, darling. Conditioners galore, diffusers, precision cuts, special combs, clip-ins, cameras, and, of course, wind machines. It requires a lot of effort to achieve effortless hair. What I really needed was any black woman or anyone with some kind of culture, cream, and a comb. But even that wasn't that simple. One time, my father's half-sister staged an intervention of sorts, determined to, quote, do something about that child's hair. It was going to be an event. I was in the second grade when my father took me to my grandfather and Nana Ruby's house in Queens. Humor was a tool I used to cope, disarm, and defend myself. I also used it to express my point of view when I had no control. It was a tool I began to sharpen quite early and, to this day, utilize frequently. In the back seat of the car on the long drive to visit my father's family, I overheard Allison, seated up front, grumbling to him about how I was absorbing my mother's quirks and eccentricities, particularly those associated with white privilege. I think she thought I was out in the world, quote, passing with our white mother, as though a child could make that distinction. And then, as if I weren't there, she went on a tirade. I continued to stare silently out of the window at the dilapidated neighborhoods we had been driving through to get to Jamaica, Queens, from Long Island. Finally, I couldn't take it any longer. Achieving an, I think, impressive impersonation of my mother, especially for a six-year-old, I groaned sarcastically in her characteristically slow, low, opera diva tone. I see we're taking the scenic route. At which Allison snapped her head toward my father with an exasperated, see, expression on her face. He stiffened, gripped the steering wheel a little tighter, and kept his eyes forward. For effect, I didn't break my bored stare out the window. No one was entertained by my little impersonation. I tried. Sweet Nana Ruby was my father's father's second wife, with whom he had a whole lot of kids, half aunties and uncles to me, who subsequently produced a gang of cousins, some of whom were around my age. My father and his father, Bob Carey, had a complicated relationship. Bob's mother was from Venezuela, and it is believed his father was black, mixed with some undocumented lightning factor, as he too was on the fairer side of what was then called the, quote, Negro spectrum. Until I was about 6 years old, my father hadn't spoken to his father in years. He was an only child and had a different mother than my grandfather's other children, and as warm and as welcoming as Nana Ruby and her house were, and from what I could see, she showered my father with love, still, she was not his mother, and perhaps he felt like a bit of an outsider with them. I think he made the effort to mend things with his father for the sake of his own children as well as himself. He must have realized how isolated I was, living with just my mother in an all-white community that was becoming increasingly hostile to me. I needed to know some family. And I am forever grateful for it because that house was a warm place bustling with family life. I loved it there. The whole neighborhood loved my grandpa. He was a regular, fun-loving guy with a hearty laugh who wore crew socks with his slide sandals. He had a little urban vineyard in his backyard in Queens. He grew sour grapes from which he made sweet homemade wine that he stored in the basement. Nana Ruby and my aunties always had something cooking in the tiny kitchen, chicken, greens, but the standout staple dish was rice and beans. I could eat whole plates of it. There was the clamoring of comforting noises, pots clanging, soul music in the background, the hum of the TV, conversations, giggles, doors opening and closing, feet running up and down the stairs. It was a lighthearted space. There were people just hanging out together, connected to one another. Being there was the closest feeling I had to having a big family, a normal family, a real family. My favorite cousins would come from the Bronx, and boy, did we play. We were a creative and mischievous bunch. Sometimes we would hang out the second-story window and drop water balloon bombs on folks passing underneath. Then we ducked down out of sight and shake in muffled hysterics. And of course, I loved anything that involved performance. My favorite was reenacting Mrs. Wiggins' sketches from the Carol Burnett Show. Unsurprisingly, I insisted on playing the lead role. I had her signature walk down pat. I stuffed my little booty with a pillow, sticking it way out, acting like I had on a tight pencil skirt. I pranced around on my tippy toes. Maybe this is why I still walk on my toes. Taking tiny steps, I'd smack imaginary gum and pretend to file my nails and speak in the ditzy, nasally voice I had down to perfection. I specialized in character voices very early. "Oh, Mrs. Wiggins," one of my cousins would say in a silly, skewed Swedish accent. I'd snap into character and we'd launch into a full-on improvisation. What I loved most was all the rambunctious laughter with my cousins. I loved the sound of my laughter as a part in the chorus of other kids who were kind of like me. Inside the house with my cousins, I may have felt a part of something, but outside with the kids in the neighborhood was a different story. It's always a different story with me. Even though my cousins didn't live on this mostly black and Hispanic block in Queens, they were known because our grandpa was that guy in the neighborhood. When we were outside playing, they'd introduce me to the other kids as their cousin, and some kid would invariably say, "She's not your cousin, she's white." "Yes, she is our cousin," they would snap right back. Who my mother was, who my father was, to whom I belonged was always in question. But hanging out with my cousins wasn't as heavy. I was part of a group. I was part of them, and they defended me. Yes, she is. It was that simple. And it was so important. My black cousins were the only cousins I knew when I was a little girl. Because my mother's side of the family, the white side, had disowned her, I had no way of having a real relationship with any of them as a child. My cousins were well put together because their mothers were very well put together. One auntie in particular was younger, juicy, and just gorgeous. She looked ready to twirl down the Soul Train line on TV. Her makeup was consistently impeccable, lips glossed up like glass. She wore funky chic ensembles, and her hair was always in some superb, slick, snatched back style so she could feature a face. She was giving you trendy, sexy, and coordinated at all times, almost as fab as Thelma on Good Times, but a little bit thicker. This foxy auntie sold makeup at the department store counter. Now that was fabulous to me. Once she gave my favorite girl cousin and me a faux facial evaluation. As she was examining our little faces, she told Cece, "Your lips are good." Then she turned to me with a puzzled look and paused. I was wondering and worrying, what's wrong with my face? Me? "Mariah, your lips aren't full enough," she said with a sigh. I didn't know what they weren't full enough for, but I fully accepted her analysis as fact. A few years later, I was about 12 years old and hanging out with a white girlfriend at a department store on Long Island where they were offering free makeup demos at one of the counters. My friend, by local standards, was a beauty, big blue eyes, a thin nose, and very thin lips. I, no doubt, had on some haphazard ensemble, and who knows what the hair was doing that day. Clearly looking our age, we sat down to have our faces done. Maybe the sales lady thought we had money to buy some makeup, or she was bored, or she simply took pity on us. Whatever the case, she began the process. As my auntie had done, she studied the contours and angles of both of our faces and reported to me, "Your lips are too full on top." "Wait," I thought. I knew I had a thin upper lip, but not as thin as my white friend, whose lip size was the standard at the time. I wanted to say, "Actually, I really want my lips to be bigger," which I did ever since the day of my auntie's evaluation, but I held my tongue. Thus, I was given two polar opposite professional opinions about my lips as a girl. They were too full for a white beauty standard and not full enough for a black one. Who was I to believe? It was like my complexes had complexes, and there was no one to tell me, "Mariah, you are good, period." And now, here we are in a world where white and black women are filling up their butts and lips like water balloons. I guess I should have had my lips injected ages ago, but it's too late. The whole world knows what my real lips look like, so why bother? Why would I do that now when I can just accentuate them with lip liner, darling? But I digress. That day at Grandpa and Nana Ruby's house, when I was 7, the time had come for my cousin's main event. My aunties had decided it was time to put me together. Some of them were gathered upstairs in Nana Ruby's bedroom, and they summoned me up. My cousins and I went upstairs toward the master bedroom, which was just right of the bathroom. I spent many moments exploring that little bathroom, fascinated with all the greasings and slatherings it contained. There were endless creams and lotions for the skin and dressings and pomades for the hair. Imagine skin lotion and hair grease. In this bathroom, every cabinet and free space was filled with mysterious potions and products. I rarely went into the master bedroom, but it too was small, cramped, and comforting. It was humid and smelled like a hot candy store. A large bed covered with a shiny, quilted, white and maroon paisley bedspread with ruffles at the hem took up most of the room. There was a full-length mirror attached to the back of the door and a low dresser drawer on which my aunties had everything laid out. There was a hot plate cranking. Upon its sizzling surface was some foreign object that resembled a garden tool with a dark wooden handle like a hammer with teeth. Though the metal part was blackened, traces of its original gold color could be seen underneath. This mysterious hammer-fork thing sat menacingly on the plate surface, getting hotter and hotter. As I crossed the threshold into the bedroom, I felt as though I had entered an alternate universe, a secret chamber, one of black girl beauty. My aunts motioned for me to sit on the side of the bed. I didn't know what kind of ritual was ahead, but I sure was excited. As I settled in on the edge of the bed, feet dangling off the side, I could feel many hands exploring the wild garden of knots, curls, and straight bits that made up my head of hair. My heart was racing. I felt like a long-lost princess sitting in her chambers, hoping this could be it, the moment of coronation when my hair would finally get done and I would be transformed, presented to the world with newfound power and grace. Finally, I thought, maybe my hair would fit in. Maybe it would fall into sleek and shiny ringlets, and I would look like my cute black girl cousins and friends who gathered in Queens. Or maybe it would lie down flat and bone straight, like the hair of the little white girls I grew up among on Long Island. Either way, I was just thrilled that my hair would at least be cared for by someone who knew what to do. The action started at the back of my head, with some pulling and separating and a little sharpness from knots coming undone. The next thing I felt was something I'll never forget. First, there was a heavy tugging and burning sensation near my neck, followed immediately by an alarming, searing, and sizzling sound and an unfamiliar and vicious smell, like a dirty stuffed animal set on fire. Along with significant smoke, a faint panic began to waft through the room. I couldn't make out much of what was being said, but I certainly heard, "Oh, shit," and "Stop, stop," several times. And then it did stop, abruptly. The excitement, the ritual, and the fixing all stopped. I stayed motionless and quiet, a small patch of hair at the nape of my neck still smoldering. My aunties were apologetic. "Sorry, baby, the hot comb is too strong for your hair," my aunties explained. "Sorry, baby." And that was the end of it. There would be no rites of passage into Black Girl Hair Society that day. I didn't emerge transformed into a presentable little girl for Harlem, Queens, or Long Island. I was still a wayward little misfit who wore a disobedient crown on her head, only now with a patch of rough, burned, uneven, and noticeably shorter hair in the back. I was far from done. On rare occasions, my mother, brother, and I would take a drive to Jones Beach as a family. Proximity to the beach was one of the few perks of being stranded on Long Island. One summer morning, the three of us, along with one of my brother's buddies, piled into my mother's clunker on wheels and hit the road to the beach. It was a clear, bright day. You could see the ocean in the sky. It was a perfect day for the beach. My mother, sporting a light blue cotton summer caftan with thin green stripes, was driving. All the windows were rolled down, giving the car a faux convertible feeling. My mother's bell sleeves flapped slightly in the breeze. She had on her signature big sunglasses, and her hair was customarily carefree. My brother sat next to her, shirtless, his big, fluffy afro bouncing gently. I sat in the back seat next to my brother's friend, quietly looking out the open window, letting the warm, salty air wash over my face. I was trying to be nonchalant, not to let on I had an enormous crush on this teen star-looking boy. His silky hair was strawberry blonde with perfect natural highlights laid out in delicate feathered layers and parted down the middle. Every dreamy strand rested in its perfect place. The car was quiet as we all enjoyed a rare moment of contentment. Gradually, though, I became aware that my hair had started to move, but it was not from the wind. Instead, it was from what felt like fingers. There were fingers searching through the wild, tangled bush that was my hair. I didn't dare move or speak, but the boy, he was gently plucking at my hair. Surgically, he worked on the smaller, tighter, matted bits at the ends with the big black plastic comb he kept permanently ensconced in his back pocket. He was using the very same comb that he ran through his field of perfect golden strands on my disheveled head. He pulled the comb from scalp to end in small sections. As each portion was released from the weight of its former twisted entrapment, it would float a little bit. Over the course of the ride, without a single word exchanged between us, he removed all the knots and confusion from my hair. By the time we arrived at the beach, my hair was no longer a burden. It was liberated. I dashed straight into the water. Oh, how I love the ocean, a gift from my mother. As I ran, I could feel my hair buoyant and blowing in the wind for the first time. Hallelujah! My hair was actually blowing like in the commercials. I dived into the first wave I could and rode it back to shore. When I stood up and touched my hair, it was not the haphazard mix of textures I was accustomed to. Instead, I touched orderly, coily, elongated curls. For the first time, my hair felt pretty. I felt pretty. I felt soft and light, as if the shame I'd been carrying had been plucked out of me and washed away. As I stood in the waist-deep water, reveling in the newfound confidence brought by my liberated curls, a sudden wall of ocean appeared, crashing down, pounding against my back. My feet were swept up off the sandy floor and over my head. My tiny body was tossed like a rag doll in the strong waves that had suddenly kicked up. I had no sense of equilibrium or orientation, but I knew I was being pulled down, tumbling in surging, dark water mixed with frothy white foam and grit that was beating against my body like boxing gloves made of sandpaper. Even if I could tell which way was up and how to get there, I knew I wasn't strong enough to overcome the powerful currents, so I relaxed my body and went with it. I surrendered. By what I believe to be God's grace, the ocean decided to give me back to the earth. I lay motionless on the grainy, wet sand, winded and salty. When I realized I was alive, I stood up to look for my mother. I spied her and my brother lying on an olive blanket in the distance, shades on, nonchalantly sunbathing, oblivious. I released a mighty wail, which devolved into hysterical crying, finally catching my mother's attention. Yet another close encounter with death. To calm my shattered 7-year-old nerves, someone took me up to the boardwalk, to the hot dog stand. I was a wreck, but my hair wasn't. It was still in wavy ringlets. I had achieved perfect beach hair. That day, I almost died, but my hair was done. A girl's best friend. From the moment I saw her, I felt both awe and identification. I idolized her. She was like a living doll, but neither baby nor Barbie. Though she was a real, elegant, grown-up woman, she appeared pure and flawless, as if made of delicate lacquered porcelain. I'd never seen anyone like her. Such a radiant, glamorous, vulnerable, yet powerful being. She was supernatural. I stood there staring, fascinated and frozen before the bright screen where she lived. One evening, I had been walking aimlessly down the hall in one of the many houses we lived in. As I passed my mother's dark little bedroom, I casually wandered in. I can't remember whether I saw or heard her first, but I know something carried me into that room. The bedroom was lit only by the washed-out colors of the old TV facing the bed where my mother was lying in silhouette watching a special about the life and death of Marilyn Monroe. I softly pushed open the bedroom door, walking in on the iconic scene from Gentlemen Prefer Blondes in which Marilyn sings "Diamonds Are a Girl's Best Friend." She was the most beautiful person I had ever seen. Her energy was like a fairy's, but she looked like a goddess, swathed in a luxurious electric pink silk gown and matching opera gloves, with diamonds of every size dripping from her ears and wrapped around her neck and wrists. The only bits of skin exposed were her face, her shoulders, and her arms down to the elbow, yet I remember her flesh seeming so rich and creamy, glistening like homemade ice cream. Her hair was just a few shades lighter, dazzling like finely spun gold. She was voluptuously shaped with round, curvy hips, a small, cinched waist, proud, purposeful breasts, and arms that stretched wide and hugged close. She was poised like a dancer, yet her feet didn't seem to move. Instead, scores of people danced around her, fawning and fanning, kneeling and bowing down to her, conveying her above their heads like Cleopatra. Maybe she was a queen, I thought, the shining queen of movie stars. I'd never heard the name Marilyn Monroe before that moment, but I was quickly hooked. Not your typical third-grade fare, perhaps, but my childhood was anything but typical. My mother very lovingly supported my fascination with Marilyn. While most girls my age adorned their walls with pictures of Holly Hobby, the frontier ragdoll with freckles and blonde yarn braids in a strawberry print bonnet. I had a poster of Marilyn Monroe dressed as a sensuous showgirl, complete with a black beaded bustier, fishnets, and black patent leather pumps. I gazed up at Marilyn before I went to sleep and first thing when I woke up. Later, my mother bought me Marilyn, a biography by Norman Mailer. Though I was way too young for the material, like Marilyn herself, I read voraciously. I pored over the large, glossy photos of her, studying all her different moods and looks. She was a shapeshifter. In some photos, she was impossibly beautiful and glamorous. In others, she seemed shattered and about to disappear. Her hair shifted shapes too. Pin curls, pigtails, sweeping updos, bobs with deep diving waves. I even detected unruly curls and familiar fuzz underneath the perfect, almost white blonde wave of her hair. There was also something in her physicality, something about her body type that didn't read as typically Caucasian to me. Not only was she curvy, she had a very particular sensuality, bordering on soulful. I read a lot about Marilyn, conspiracy theories about her death and her upbringing. The more I read, the more I connected with her and understood why I was drawn to her. She had a very difficult childhood, moving from one foster home to another. That was close to my story, being uprooted and unprotected, feeling like an outsider. I intimately understood her struggles with poverty and family. Ultimately, what I loved about Marilyn was her ability to come from nothing, to belong to no one, and evolve into a huge icon. I latched on to that. I believed in that. I've heard Marilyn might have even been my mother's inspiration for my name. The first four letters are the same, M-A-R-I. However, my father claimed that my name comes from the Black Mariah, Mariah, the infamous police van used to haul people off to prison in the UK. The story also goes that I was named after a hit 1950s show tune they call The Wind Mariah from Paint Your Wagon, a Broadway show about the California Gold Rush. Both references use the soft pronunciation with the second syllable having a ry sound. Perhaps it's a combination of all three, a 1950s starlet, a show tune, and a paddy wagon. Whatever the origin, when I was younger, I didn't like my name. No one else had it, and when you're a kid, that's not cool. I always wished I had a regular name like Jennifer or Heather. There were no cute stickers, keychains, or mini license plates with my name on them, but the worst part was hardly anyone could pronounce it. I always dreaded seeing a substitute teacher, knowing roll call would be a Maria Maya calamity. I wouldn't meet another Mariah until I was about 18 years old. She was a cool Black girl, and we commiserated good-humoredly on the mispronunciations of our childhood. I had no way to imagine that only a few years after that, many people would be naming their children Mariah after me. Of all the supposed inspirations for my name, the Marilyn Monroe connection resonates the most with me. Self-created and controlled, confident and vulnerable, womanly and childlike.